Welcome back, WNST, Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. This one is going to be a thrill, Don Moeller. I want to give a shout out to Fadley's, where I had a crab cake. I just knocked out the end of the mac and cheese, and my wife was sitting there eating it the other night. She's like, that's really good mac and cheese. We're going to get more of that. So crab cakes. I brought home fresh fish from Fadley's last week, Don Moeller, and we made it. We made steak fish in my kitchen, and my wife ate it. So love to Fadley's. Ship those crab cakes. They're awesome. Our friends at State Fair in Catonsville. And Don, if we were doing this, I don't know whether we'd be at El Guapo having tacos and maybe some special adult libations, or whether we'd be over at State Fair having a chicken and waffles, but you've been trying to put this together. We're 2 years into the show. We're on episode 600 or whatever. And I know this one is the most special to you.
Well, I have my good friends on today that have run this county for many, many years. And we decided that we would do a quarterly segment called The Executives and invite every single Baltimore County executive to come on the show, talk about their experiences, share their wisdom. I really am looking forward to it. We have former Baltimore County Executive Ted Venatulis, 1974 to 1978. Don Hutchinson, 78 to 86. Dennis Rasmussen, 86 to 90. Dutch Ruppersberger, 2nd District Congressman, 94 to 202. Jim Smith, 2002 to 2010. So it is a real honor to welcome all of you. Welcome to Baltimore Positive. And Dutch, when we set this up, I noticed you're on mute, Dutch, so you're going to need to unmute. But when we set this up, little did we know what you and the nation would be going through over the past week or so. I'm wondering, Dutch, if you can take our listeners back to the morning. Take us through your day of January the 6th when we all watched in horror.
Well, January 6th, we had intelligence and we got information that there was going to be possibly a serious problems with a lot of the radical people who eventually stormed the Capitol. My office is overlooks the Capitol, and everyone told we were given orders to stay in our offices with our staff. So we were there the whole time, but I had a picture of what was going on from the beginning. You know, in our roles as county executive, we work with our chief of police and they brief us about crowds. And when we go to crowds as county executives, so, you know, I kind of knew a little bit about what the policy would be as far as protecting the Capitol, as far as having rows of people that if one group was not was going to breach, so to speak, you'd have another group behind it. Well, that didn't happen. I felt secure in the beginning when I saw the huge crowds and the rebel flags. I thought, well, we've got plenty of FBI in there, informants. I know we have information. As it turned out, there was no help there whatsoever. And that was because the Sergeant of Arms of the Senate and the House, and they're in charge of the police department. And the chief of police, 48 hours before the event, said he was really worried. He felt we needed backup. That was important because of everything they were hearing and their sources of information from the FBI and other groups. And the two sergeant of arms said, no, we're not going to do that. We think we can handle it, caring more about the political issue than it was about what was happening there on the ground. Then all of a sudden it started and people were just swarming the Capitol, climbing the walls. I couldn't believe that this was the United States of America, our Capitol. Our Capitol is an image throughout the world of freedom and liberty, and here we were being taken over. It was an insurrection, and we saw backup coming. I think the Capitol Police were overwhelmed. They were also given orders not to fire, and they were just being run over. I remember.
Dutch, where were you at the time? Were you?
I was in my office in Rayburn, and I have a view of the Capitol, so I saw it all. I was right there watching it from beginning to end. And the surge. And then I started to see more reinforcements come. But this is like an hour and a half into the actual problem that occurred. And it was really more of the Metropolitan Police were involved. And then I understand the FBI started to come. There was an issue involving the military because, you know, the military has to be asked to come in. And that's really our system of government, because we don't want the military to be there and do law enforcement. We want the military to protect our country and the things that are needed there. Anyhow, it was just an overwhelming situation. And by the time the military was able to come, they came and took care of the outer perimeter. A lot of the issues and people were being shoved out of where the Capitol was.
Dutch, go ahead and reconnect there because we're losing your mic.
Okay, you are. Okay.
And fellas, when you come in, just identify who you are, because I'm going to let you guys talk amongst yourselves just for our audience that aren't watching and listening. And that way they know who. That was Ted chiming, and Ted Venatoulis, of course.
Yes.
If you just joined us, we have seven Baltimore County executives: Don Mohler, Ted Venatoulis, Don Hutchinson, Dennis Rasmussen, Dutch Ruppersberger, of course, our second district congressman, Jim Smith, and of course, Don Mohler. Go ahead, Dutch, continue. Now you're on mute. You muted yourself. There you go, pal.
Yeah, I represent NSA. I'm supposed to be pretty good at cyber. I don't know how to work the damn thing. Really, a little bit. Anyhow, so then we see what happened. Well, you could see on TV what Trump had done. He first thing for months, even a little bit before the election, he was complaining about mail-in ballots and it was bad and corrupt and that type of thing. Then when he lost, his message was, "We won, we won." And he kept saying those lies over and over. There were 60 court cases and in front of judges that he appointed. It went to the Supreme Court, which is dominated by, you have two new appointments from Trump. And still the Supreme Court held there was no fraud, nothing there. And then when you could see his comments and the things that he said were just outrageous. We're going to go, you go to the Capitol. I'm going to be there with you too. Guy didn't have the guts to go anywhere. Believe me, he went back in the Capitol, got in front of his TV, and from what I hear, was kind of pleased what was going on. So there's no question. And those of us that are lawyers, and I was a prosecutor, that right there, he was guilty of a conspiracy to encourage and recruit and to send that crowd to the Capitol and attack the Capitol. And it was wrong. It's, in my opinion, it's a crime. And we very quickly decided to impeach him. And the reason why, even though he's going out of office, I specialize in a lot of national security. So I've been to over 50 different countries. And I'm talking Iraq, Afghanistan, not Bermuda, places like that. And, we have to send a message to our allies and our enemies. This is a democracy, the United States of America. We're not going to tolerate anybody, including the United States, to conduct really attack on our nation's capital. We're not going to do it. And why we're doing this is the message that needs to be sent, and also to make sure he never runs again.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Let me ask you something about
this. Ted, just identify. This is Ted Venatoulis coming back and jumping into the conversation.
One of the issues, Dutch, is there's no question that Trump needs to be impeached. That he fed this thing, he inspired it, he then literally organized it through his tweets and everything else. One of the issues that really concerns all of us, I'm sure, is the complicity. This thing doesn't happen on its own. And Trump didn't do it on his own. He had enablers. And that enabler group was 200 Republicans who continued after the ruckus, after the riots, voted to sustain the conspiracy theory that they were floating, which caused it all, that the election was a fraud. What do you do with those guys? How can elected officials of that nature, 200 of them, continue to be tolerated in the House of Representatives?
That's a good point that you raise. A lot of them I've worked with. I've worked with the National Security, Defense Appropriations, Intelligence. I just don't understand. I've had some conversations. I think they feel that that's what their constituents wanted them to do. There is so much of a following of this guy that believe his lies and don't understand what he's done as far as managing COVID and caring about himself and no one else. I mean, these people are just really worried, and he's a vindictive guy, and he's a vindictive son of a bitch. That's what he is, and really he. He people out there are concerned about.
And you're being generous with your comment.
Well, he's talking Nestor's language.
Yeah,
Nestor.
Right. Well, I got my Dundalk jacket on, man. I voted for and against all you guys.
I represent Dundalk. And there's, I understand why they like Trump. I understand some of the issues there. And that's they're right. But when you follow a guy who lies, who says, I won the election big time. I mean, when you see his actions, when you see what he did to our country, you know, on January the 6th, you can't tolerate that. I do want to talk about some of the Republicans. Liz Cheney is one of them. She's a great person. She's a friend of mine. She's the third in leadership. Her father was the vice president. And she came out strong against Trump. And then what he did was so outrageous. It's the worst that any president in the history of our country has done and turned his back on his country. And she was one of the first ones to come out and said, I am voting, you know, against him and to impeach him. And there were nine other ones too that did that. And, you know, we have to make sure that the radical crazies, so to speak. And when I'm talking about crazies are the Proud Boys and in those groups, don't try to hurt them too. So I'm going to.
Hey, Dutch.
Yeah.
Former Baltimore County Executive Jim Smith jumping in.
One of the things that's a concern to me with the impeachment, I support the impeachment, but the trial, the one thing that we really should avoid, I think, is the possibility that the Congress is going to be, the Senate's going to be so tied up with the trial that they won't be able to move forward with a lot of the Biden confirmations of appointments and a lot of the Biden initiatives that they want to hit the ground running on in order to try to turn this country away from where we've been as quickly as possible to where we should be going. And how is Congress going to be able to handle both the trial? And again, I'm not against the trial. I don't want to see it handicap or hurt the initiation of what we hope will be a new era for the United States.
I mean, as former county executives, as we all are, we know we have to every day manage our jobs. And I think at this point, Biden will be focused with his good team to deal with the issues that you talked about, the everyday issues, the highest priorities, which number one is COVID. I think if you look at this charging document, it's maybe a couple pages and that's it. It's very simple. You know, this is what we see. This is the evidence we have. We have Trump literally on TV. So we've got the evidence that is there. But it's so important, I think, to our country that we follow through with this to say we're not going to tolerate anybody, including a president of the United States, that's going to stand in the way of our democracy. And that's the bottom line issue.
I'm for that, Jim Smith.
Yeah, I know you are. But I think there's enough people that we have and members and you know, in Congress, we specialize in different areas. And because of that, we will have the ability to do what we need to do. It'll be more on TV. People with the nation will see it. The world will see it. And that's what we want. Because
can I add to that, Dutch?
Yeah.
It seems to me and Jim that Nancy and Joe know what they're doing. And if the two of them are on board on this, they're going to do both things at the same time. It also appears that they'll get who's the guy that runs the Senate for the Republicans? I don't even want to mention his name.
McConnell.
Right. They might get him on board because he's wised up about Trump as well. So it seems to me, and I think all of us, if we were there, could make sure that both of these were handled properly. First of all, they debate, a couple of hours maybe on the floor during the day. They meet Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. There's plenty of room for them to add to their workload and handle both of these, at least for, I don't know, what will it last, a month? Dutch, the last time the impeachment only took 20 or 21 days. So it's not a long period of time.
This will not be as long. One other thing there are a couple other things I want to say too. Number one, there is some issues out there about other members, some Republicans possibly being involved in the conspiracy or taking some of the members, because there's no question it was command and control. This just wasn't a wild mob. These people were trained. They knew what to do. They had the equipment. So we have to make sure that we do an extensive investigation, and we will. That has to be done. I think that right now we have to let the investigators do the job, get the evidence. I know part of their strategy is to arrest as many people as they can when they get the facts. And the reason that will deter them getting involved in what we're talking about now, the chatter, you know, between now and the inauguration. Because it's still, I'm not as worried about the Capitol. I mean, you know, you can always drop bombs or something like that, but we're going to have so many police officers and military people in the nation's capital. You're not going to be able to hardly move. I mean, you're talking thousands and thousands. I'm worried about state capitals, especially a state capital like Michigan, where that governor was threatened and where they literally were focused on trying to take her out. I'm worried about the whole country. But this is when we stand up, and we're going to stand up strong, and we have the expertise in our federal agencies, our state and local agencies, to protect our citizens, and that's what we'll do.
Dutch, you know, it seems to me, before we turn to Dennis and Don, and I want to get their perspective as really coming from the east side, but it seems to me that the last parting gift from Donald Trump is to deprive our nation of what has been a tradition for a couple hundred years, which is this wonderful public celebration of the transfer of power. And when I see the way the nation's capital is going to be locked down and the metro is going to be shut down and people really aren't going to be able to attend, it was going to be smaller anyway, obviously because of COVID. But to me, this is his last parting gift, one of the many things that I'll never forgive him for. But I want to turn to former county executives, Dennis Rasmussen and Don Hutchinson. You are our East Side guys. I mean, you born, bred, you knew it. Your political base was over there. Dennis,
wait a minute. I'm from Highland Town.
That doesn't count.
East Side.
All right, we'll make you partially East Side guy. Dennis, describe Trumpism, its origins, and you and Donald both give us a view as to why it became so popular and took such deep hold on the East Side. And it's Nestor's hometown as well. He knows that. What is it? What is the appeal of Trumpism, and where did it come from, Dennis?
Well, I think just I want to say, first of all, you know, Highland Town's always been Essex with grass. That's the only difference. By nature, I'm an optimist. And, you know, as I looked at TV and I was shocked and outraged like everybody else on what I was seeing on TV. But it made me pause and think through, you know, why is this happening? Why do we have a divided America? And to me, it goes back, and I've seen this on the East Side, and I'm sure Dine has as well. The east side of the county used to be the Democratic heartland of the state of Maryland. And today, as we know, it's primarily represented by the Republican Party. You start to ask questions, how did this migration of ideology kind of transfer over? And I think it goes back to, decades of poor decisions by government in trying to, you know, address some of the structural issues. We all know the East Side lost probably about 200,000 jobs since 1950 on the East Side, manufacturing jobs. What did we do to try to address some of that? There were some efforts made. We all made them. But you began to see that people who were working at Bethlehem Steel or General Motors or Martin Marietta, you know, they had a good family living, paying jobs that they could support their families. I lived in Essex, Don, we lived six doors apart. Our fathers worked, mine worked at Bethlehem Steel. Don's had a small business in Essex. They were able to support our families. And now you find that people are either underemployed or unemployed. They were counting on a pension and benefits from their employers, who many just closed, left. Those benefits are gone. They can't send their kids to college. They don't have the money to be able to afford that. the little fishing boat that used to be in the driveway has been sold a long time ago. They're only going to Ocean City for a couple of days a year. They kind of get hopeless. They get desperate. And the real issue, I think, has been that over the years, if we go back to the mid-70s, and if you look then how the wealth in this country was distributed, it was pretty even. You know, you had the working class. People were working hard. They were able to support their families. Businesses were thriving. They were making good profits. And then somewhere in the 80s and 90s, this is my opinion now, in the 80s and 90s, you had the business roundtable nationally. These were the top 200 executives in the country. And they got together and said, we don't like where things are going here. We need to be able to do more for our shareholders. And they began a very aggressive program of changing economic policies, fiscal policies, tax policies. So if you go from the mid-70s up till today and look at the wealth growth in this country, it all went to the top 4%. So when the top 4% of America has a net worth equal to the bottom 140 million people, that's a problem. And what we've done, we've forced people into poverty, and there's no way out. And they're frustrated. And I see a lot of that on the East Side. I have a huge family, and I hear that from some of my relatives who are just frustrated and don't know what to do. And they're looking for some kind of solution. And it's not really that they're like big Trumpers. It's just that they're looking for some other approach or some other initiatives that's going to try to help them.
And Don Hutchinson, how about jumping in there?
Don, just a couple of thoughts. I think that Dennis is absolutely correct when he talks about economic issues. I think that it's, in some cases, even more direct. Back 4 years ago, I came home one day and said to my wife that I thought that Trump was going to win. And, of course, it made me sick to even be able to say that. And it was because of a visit that I had made to Essex and Middle River and Dundalk with the realization that every city in the United States, particularly on this side of the Mississippi River, but every city in the United States has an Essex and a Dundalk and a Middle River in it. Everyone has exactly the demographics of what Dennis just described, the economic demographics and the racial and ethnic demographics. I think so. Everything he said, I think, is right, and I think you can multiply that to every city around the United States. I think there are two other things here, though, that really drive this. First of all, Trump, his very presence, his mouth, his language, has empowered people to say what they have always thought, and they think what he thinks. And so many of his voters think what he thinks.
I call it Archie Bunker, just from something I remember.
It's an Archie Bunker kind of mentality. The ethnic slur became appropriate. The racial slur became appropriate. Before, people thought in those terms, but they never really were empowered to say it. He gave people the right to an empowerment to say it, to wear it on their lapels. Organizationally, there are also two other things that happened, and I don't think we can. And again, this is nationwide. This is not just here in Baltimore. The blue-collar labor unions disappeared. We thought people were Democrats because they loved the Democratic Party. Well, yeah, that's partially true, but in part they were Democrats because the labor unions told them they should be. And the labor unions told them that the party that was going to do what they needed to have done were going to be the Democrats. And the labor unions delivered the vote, and they delivered the money that was essential for Democrats to win. Secondly, and we're all guilty of this, it all actually started with Ted Venatopoulos, and it carried on with me. And again, this is nationwide, but in Baltimore and in Baltimore County, it started with Ted. We dismantled the political organizations that created jobs for people just within the organization themselves. We got rid of patronage. We got rid of all of these things that we thought were contributing, and I think in many cases they were, that were contributing to the dishonesty of so many political people. If you read Rachel Maddow's book, all of us should be reading Rachel Maddow's book right now. Right now, you should read it. You should also read a book called Cast that has just been published. Those two books are essential for us, I think, to understand what happened. If you look at the corruption that happened back in the early 70s, and this kind of corruption happened all over the country. If you look at the kind of corruption, there were a bunch of Ted Venatoulis's and Don Hutchinson's and Dennis Rasmussen's and Jim Smith and Dutch Rubenbergers that were absolutely committed to cleaning it up. And we did. We all ran inherently honest operations in our government. And we delivered services a little bit more efficiently because of it. But the dismantling of those political organizations did not allow. Look at what happened just a couple years ago. Johnny Osheski ran for county executive without one endorsement of essential political organization to his operation. There were people here in this room or in this conversation that were supportive of him and that were important. But the old political organizations that used to drive that are gone. They don't exist anymore in the way that we knew it through the old civil service. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it's different. And those things have driven the political operations and the ability to deliver a particular vote based on a particular set of outcomes that were expected. All of that has changed. Organization has changed, the labor unions and political organizations disappearing. And Trump has empowered people to show their prejudices and their hatred.
Again, if you're just joining us, a very special, special edition of Baltimore Positive. We have former Baltimore County executives Ted Venatoulis, Don Hutchinson, Dennis Rasmussen, Dutch Rupersberger, 2nd District Congressman, Jim Smith, and yours truly, along with Nestor Aparicio. Dutch, I wonder if you and Ted, because you certainly know her better than anyone, and maybe you can start it off, and Ted, you jump in. Dutch, talk about our friend, the Speaker, and how she has handled herself through this entire period and conducted herself. And Dutch, I noticed, there you are, you're off mute. Talk a little bit about Nancy. We all know her. We all love her. Talk about how she's dealt with the membership during this.
Nancy, a very special person. That's because she's from Baltimore. I remind her of that all the time. And she's a really good friend of Ted's also. And she was also a very, very close to her brother, Tommy D'Alessandro, who just passed away, who really helped mentor Nancy. He helped mentor a lot of us that were in politics. Nancy represents a very liberal area, San Francisco. And she, before she got into politics, she had, I think, five kids, and but she was very active behind the scenes. And then she got into Congress, and then she's moved up. She has the ability to see, to deal with all members. We have far left, we have moderates, we have liberals, whatever we have, she has the ability to pull these people in together. Her energy level is unbelievable. Just what she's been going through right now, and the day and night, not getting any sleep, and still, you know, communicating her message and where we are. I think the way she's handled Trump, who we know is a big bully. And from the very beginning, she didn't put up with his bulliness. And it sometimes I'm not leaving. You know, you're not going to bully me around, whatever. And she started to gain respect. And we always have issues in our own parties. You know, the far left will come after the moderates, and the far right, you know, they deal with issues. But Nancy had the ability to bring all these different groups in on the big issues, the issues that were really important to people. And you know, if you really look at all of us in politics, it's about really people will vote for someone because how you treat their families, how you provide education, how you provide safety, you know, police, and then infrastructure. I mean, those are the basics. And Nancy understood that. And then her ability during this period of time, and I'm talking first COVID, forget what just happened, but first COVID, and her ability to stay there and to be able to get the money together and the money that was needed, you know, by this country to stay alive so that we wake up from this terrible situation, we won't be in a depression for a long period of time. So I'm going to stop here because I just want to say she's a great leader. She listens. She's smart. She's smooth. She's classy. And she can fight.
Well, you know, it's funny, Dutch. My wife, before we turned to dead, my wife channeled her inner Ginger Rogers yesterday. And for our young listeners, go Google Ginger Rogers. My wife, as Nancy's running throughout, you know, from the dais, through the hall, signing the book, back to do press conferences, going out to sign the troops, to thank the troops. My wife says, and keep in mind, she's doing it all in high heels.
Yeah, that's true.
So I thought that exactly. Sort of, so let, doing let it all me, in high
let
heels.
Let me give one example, Nancy, I'll stop. You know, she appointed me to head up the Intelligence Committee for the Democrats and in leadership. And that was a big job, a big deal. She allowed me and my counterpart, Mike Rogers, who's Republican, to run the operation. We briefed her all the time. She was a part of what we call the Gang of Eight. Not one time did she ever interfere with me. And yet, on numerous occasions, she disagreed with me. So she understood. She was on top of the situation. But when she appointed people in leadership to do the job, she let them do the job if they were doing a good job.
Well, Ted, I think you're the only one in the group, I think I can safely say this, that actually escorted a young Nancy D'Alessandro to either a school or a CYO dance. So give us the view from Highlandtown of your friend, the speaker, how she's handled herself.
Well, I did know Nancy before she really got into politics, always in politics because of the family. But she was pretty shy, and really I saw no interest in either of us at that time engaging in politics, although we talked about it all the time. I often felt that we may have been no reflection guys, the only two guys on the East Side who read the New York Times, and that would have been somewhat remarkable at that time. We were just growing up.
You had to go up to Broadway to get it? Where'd you get it?
We found it. I can't remember the drugstore. One of the drugstores there had it. In any event, she's very, I think Dutch hit it on a number of scores. She is perhaps next to my wife, the smartest woman I've ever met. She is really smart. She can talk about Emily Dickinson or about the Marshall Plan. She can tell you about NATO, and she can tell you about agricultural subsidies. It doesn't make any difference. Contrast that to Trump, who doesn't know anything about anything. And that's one of the things that's something about her. And she knew this at an early age. I mean, of course, it wasn't politics we were talking about. But if you talked about culture, about poetry, about movies, she was very friendly. She always had an open heart and open attitude. Her friends were always upbeat. I'll tell you, though, about her politics. First of all, it just wasn't – it was mostly the family, mostly her mother. Her mother was tough. That's where Nancy really gets her toughness from. Her decency, I think, she gets from her brother, Tommy, who, as all of us knew him, was one of the most decent human beings in the world. And but it was her mother – who really engendered this toughness that Nancy has and this organizational ability. And Dutch, I think, can speak to this in many ways. She understands the ground game in this business, and she understands how to affect that and, as a result, help her members get reelected. She also understands the importance of money. She may be the biggest most powerful fundraiser in the history of America, not necessarily giving it like the Koch brothers and people like that, but organizing to get it. And that's always, I couldn't understand how she could move around the country so incredibly. I have one personal story. I was in Houston with one of my businesses having a meeting, and for some reason, I talked to Nancy, and she said she was coming to Houston. I think her brother was working there in one of those. He was a big developer, like worked in a Rouse company and others like that. And he was working in a big project in Houston. She said she was coming down. So we had lunch. I met her at a particular restaurant. When I went, she was sitting there with another person. I got there and she introduced me, and this guy was now an ambassador, and he's given $1 million to the party. But here she was in Houston raising money, coming down there and flying, and then going back to Washington for a business. But it was a one-on-one meeting. And think about doing this all over the country, time and time again. And it's that energy, I think, that she brings to it. So when they want to challenge her for being speaker, I say, you guys are wacky. You have no idea what that job entails, the way she's created it. She ought to be speaker for life, as far we all should be concerned. Never mind that she's from Baltimore. And the other thing I'd like to add, and I think Dutch is a testament to this, she's always taken care of our Baltimore gang. She groomed Van Hollen. She's grooming Jamie Raskin today. She has a great tenderness and sensitivity to the folks that represent our state. And she's never forgotten. She's never left East Baltimore. And you can tell that when she comes to the events that we have for her. She just doesn't. She loves it. She always wants to come back. She recognizes people. They enjoy seeing her. She's just she's quite a remarkable person, and we're fortunate. One other tale. I think she really got engaged in elected politics in two ways. One was the Jerry Brown thing that we all participated in one way or the other. Not necessarily we were all on the same side, but we were all in that campaign. It came about. And that's okay. We all represented decent people. I was Don. I was in Essex having lunch. I think the place was called The Last End. I'm not sure. There was a little place down there, and I tried to scatter my lunches. And I get a phone call, and the guy. Nancy had said, "Look, Ted, my governor wants to run for president." I told him about you guys, you and Tommy, and, you know, I said, well, look, Nance, we'll help him. Let's see, it was 76 and our organization was big, and we had all you guys, Dennis and Don, and all our East End organization. We had labor, but we had a pretty good group. So I'm at this restaurant now, and I get a call, and the owner comes over and says, Mr. Executive, you have a call. I said, well, who's it from? How the hell did he get me here? He says, well, he claims he's a governor. I said, all right. So I go over. I thought it was Mandel or something. And he says, I'm Jerry Brown. I'm governor. I said, Jerry, what are you calling me here for? He said, well, Nancy told me that I should talk to you because I'm interested in running for governor and want to know if you guys would handle my campaign over there. I said, well, Jerry, I said, you're really crazy. I mean, this is it's only 8 weeks left. We can't. How do you mobilize? We can't even get delegates on the slate. It's too late. The time is gone. He says, I don't care. I want to do it. Nancy keeps saying, this is the place to go. We can carry it and it'll be a good boost for me. I said, well, okay. Here's the deal, though. You got to give us 2 or 3 days every week here going out. You got to raise all the money and you got to keep the California guys out of this campaign. We're going to run it. We're going to run it. I don't want them intruding or interfering. We had this thing about foreigners. A Californian was a foreigner coming into our state and telling us how to run it. So he agreed to everything. He came in, and I said, the other thing, and Nancy has to come here and help us run the city. She knows everybody. Family is important. I said, so you got to somehow just get her to be over here all summer. And they did. He agreed to everything, and Nancy came, and we waged that campaign, and it was a – you know, it was really a big victory for him. He unfortunately did not have this going on in other places. Well, the point is, after that campaign, I talked to him. I said, look, you got to take care of Nancy now, whatever she wants, whatever she needs. And this guy, though, she's on a library board. She's now becomes Democratic chairman of the Democratic Party in California. And her congressman passes away, Phil Burton. I don't know, Dutch, if you remember him or know him. I'm not sure if his brother followed him. But Phil Burton passed away. His wife became the member for a while, and she got ill. And Nancy was very, very close to her. And at her deathbed, Mrs. Burton said, Nancy, I want you to take my seat. And Nancy had never, never thought about running for office, quite frankly. She had was on the outside. She liked it. She participated. She held fundraisers for people over there. She was on some boards and commissions, but never thought about running. Well, she did. It wasn't an easy race, by the way. California has a very strong gay community, and they had put up their own candidate and thought that they were going to win. And Nancy, with incredible organization skills, won. And that's the story of how she got to Congress. It wasn't long from there. And Dutch, I think she was on the Intelligence Committee, as you were, if I understand. And ultimately worked her way up. To become,
I wonder, wonderful memories and reminiscence of the speaker. I wonder if we can reminisce a little bit about someone else who's had an incredible legacy in this state. And Dennis, both you and Donald were in the legislature. Mike Miller, longest serving Senate president in the history of the nation. Dutch, certainly you and Jim dealt with Mike as county executives. Dennis and Donald, maybe just share a little bit for our folks your memories of working with Mike Miller and what made him the lion that he is, and any maybe special interactions that you had with Mike.
Well, let me just start with that. I actually went to the legislature before Mike Miller did. I was in the legislature in the House of Delegates for 2 years before Mike came in. He was actually working as a staffer for the Prince George's County delegation. But at the time, there were no office buildings. Like we have them today. The Baltimore County delegation was working out of the Shaw House, which is on State Circle. And we had no offices. We actually had a classroom environment. Literally. It was as if you were into an elementary classroom environment. There were three telephones for a delegation of 22 delegates. Miller was a staffer in the same building working with the Prince George's County delegation. One day I was leaving late at night. Our cars were parked out in a parking lot, and I saw a briefcase. And somebody had abandoned the briefcase. Somebody had forgotten the briefcase. I went in, looked at it, picked it up, opened it up, and it says Mike Miller, Prince George's County. So the next day I went back. I didn't look through the briefcase, had no idea what it was, and I delivered it to him. This is the first time I ever met him. Mike said, "Oh, my God." He said, "I don't know who you are, delegate." He said, "But you just saved my life." He said, "My entire law practice is in that briefcase." He said, "Thank you so much." And from that point on, we became friends.
It's like the Holy Grail you found.
Yeah, right. So he came in 2 years later, went to the House of Delegates, and then we went to the Senate together, and he sat in front of me in the state Senate. And we became friends, although politically we were quite different. Mike really was an ally of Steny Hoyer. He was the ultimate ally on the floor of the Senate as a young state senator, as an ally to Steny Hoyer, who was the president of the Maryland State Senate. During my 4 years in the Maryland State Senate, Steny Hoyer was my Senate president. Mike was clearly somebody, and I think this is what distinguishes him with anybody else. He loved the state Senate like he loved his own family and didn't want to go anywhere else. That's obvious. I mean, I'm stating the obvious. But you could tell it in those first, he just loved what he was doing. He loved the history of it. He loved the significance of it. He loved the idea of being a part of a legislative body. He had no interest in an executive responsibility. I moved on 4 years later to run for county executive. And Mike stayed where he was, and then he stayed where he was, and then he stayed where he was, and he moved himself up into the leadership of the state Senate. As guys like Mickey Steinberg moved on to become lieutenant governor, and Jim Clark was chosen not to be president of the Senate when he tried to seek a second term, and Mike Miller ultimately wound up as the state Senate president. And he has been a remarkable leader. He has been, in recent years, the conservative leader of a liberal-tending state Senate. The state Senate has changed significantly since I was a part of it, since Dennis was a part of it. And Mike has been the one person that has pulled the state Senate back to the center. Now, he had help with committee chairs. He had a committee chair from Southern Maryland that was remarkably important on the Finance Committee because he was associated with Mike. So Mike has been a guiding leader in the legislature and has known how to establish relationships with governors, both Democrat and Republican, Larry Hogan particularly, not necessarily with Bob Ehrlich. but with Larry Hogan particularly. Sometimes, and I'll finish with this, and Dennis, sometimes his greatest strain was with the Speaker of the House of Delegates, who was always a Democrat. And sometimes, if there was a strain between leadership, it was between Mike and the Speaker, who had sometimes a hard time moving in lockstep. But Mike is a remarkable leader, and his resignation is a first as president of the Senate, then as a senator, is a great loss to the Senate and to the state. And I know the family is going through this great struggle.
Dennis, before we turn to Jim and Dutch and get their recollections as county executives who had to go down and talk to the Senate president about important issues, what are your recollections as a young state senator with Mike Miller?
I thought Don gave an excellent kind of overview assessment of who Mike Miller is. I served with him in the Senate as well. We shared leadership positions. I was chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and Mike was chairman of the Judicial Proceedings Committee. So we worked together in leadership under Mickey Steinberg when he was president of the Senate. I was always very impressed with Mike. One important thing with him, nothing was more important than the integrity of the institution of the Senate of Maryland. And it's very consistent on with Don saying. He loved the Senate. He respected everyone that was in it. Had kind of the same type of leadership that the Speaker, Pelosi, has. You're appointed a chairman. He very seldom interfered, and in my new role as a government relations consultant, you very seldom really went to Mike for anything because he would basically say, "Go talk to the chairman." I mean, there were some rare occasions where he would get more involved in issues. He would be very selective about that, but really, the integrity of the Senate and his integrity was extremely important, and he was very good to work with. And I think the Senate really looked to Mike for his guidance and leadership. It just didn't look at it as a kind of a protocol position. They really looked to him for guidance, and he has brought the Senate back to a more central institution.
Jim, I always remember, I'm gonna turn to Jim Smith before we go to Dutch. Jim, I always remember we used to laugh and shake our heads. He could get away with certain things that very few electeds that I've ever seen could. And that's the way he would chide and cajole and pick on those in the state who he didn't think were necessarily ponying up what they should to help elect other Democrats. And it was inevitable. All the time he would get up at a public thing and look for Jim Smith. Where's that Jim Smith? Maybe you talk a little bit about that.
Where's that skinflint? It won't give me that for my senatorial campaign committee. He did have that kind of an approach with me. But you know, the thing about him, and this follows really what Dennis said in a way, I didn't go to him for that much when it came to the substance of government. He and I had political conversations, but the reason I didn't is because he really did empower the chairs of his committees, and I had issues that had to involve the various committees, like the Finance Committee, And because he didn't interfere with them, you could actually spend worthwhile time with the chair of a committee and make progress. And to my knowledge, in my 8 years, he never interfered with any decision that any of the chairs made in connection with requests that I might have for whatever it was. But he did. I was a pretty strong fundraiser. And he did like to get in my pocket a lot, but we had he called me a skinflint, but because he always wanted much more.
And he liked to do it, Jim. Jim, he liked to do it in front of 400 or 500
people. Oh, I know. Yeah.
It wasn't a private conversation.
Oh, no. He wanted everybody to know how tight I was. But,
hey, Dutch. Dutch, nobody enjoyed the interplay of Annapolis more than you and the late, great Mike Davis. You must have some recollections of working with the Senate president down in Annapolis and some Mike Miller stories.
Well, let me give you one story. It's about the Ravens. And before I get into that story, I went to the University of Maryland and played lacrosse. And Mike loved University of Maryland. You know, other than the state Senate and his family, that was his love in life. It was University of Maryland and University of Maryland sports. We would get together. I played lacrosse, so I had a scholarship for lacrosse. And Gary Williams, the basketball coach, was playing basketball at the time. So we were all friends. And then, when Gary got to be coach, we'd all get together. Mike would be a part of it. And it was just talking about the games. And by the way, if Gary lost, you don't want to be around him because he was really not nice to be around when he lost.
And sweaty.
Well, that too, right. and he would never take his shirt off. You've got that right. But let me tell you the story now to get back to the Ravens. And we loved getting the Ravens back to Baltimore. And we lost our Colts, as you know, in the middle of the night, and it broke our hearts. But we worked very hard to help Modell come back to Baltimore. But what happened is that the Redskins, and Mike loved the Redskins too, the Redskins were trying to fight the deal. So we were in a battle, and eventually we needed to go to the legislature for the stadium money, you know, to borrow the money to build the stadium. And Mike was fighting it, and it was a battle. We were back and forth. Thank goodness Cass Taylor was working with us, and he was helping us bring the Ravens. And Paris Glendening was the governor, and Kurt Schmoke was the mayor. And we ended up winning that by, I think it was three votes in the Senate and five votes in the House, or we wouldn't have the Ravens today. But Mike, you know, he was a great leader. I think he's probably one of the best leaders that we've had in the state of Maryland as far as leadership abilities and getting things done. And when the battle was over, we shook hands, and that was it. And he didn't take it personally. He fought like hell. He respected the fact that he had an adversary that wanted the Ravens, and we did, and we got the Ravens. But Mike, to see him, you know, in the later stages and the pain he's going through, I mean, we are all praying for him and trying to help any way that we can. We can go on with a lot of Mike Miller's stories, his strength and power, but he was smart enough to know what he didn't know. And that's why he allowed his, which is great, he oversaw his committee, and they'd tell him where they were and what the status of the issues were, but he would let them run the committees. And that's why he was so successful.
Dutch, I got a constituent question here before we let you go, because we're getting up on a clock and we know your time's valuable here. Part of what I've witnessed in the last couple of days since the insurrection is your colleagues on the other side of the aisle walking into the Capitol building and not passing through a metal detector. I'm concerned for all of you when that sort of thing happens, when someone's waving guns out on the internet, gets elected on that. Obviously a part of whatever the conspiracy will be in the future, but I'm concerned about that part of this when people are talking insurrection, supporting insurrection, and passing by metal detectors when they're coming into your chamber.
Nestor, they're the same guys that aren't wearing masks.
Yes,
you're not right. Encouraging other people to wear masks. They're not going to go through.
You know what?
Clearance procedures, because it's an imposition on their liberty. This is the biggest form of whatever in the history of our country. This is just despicable. And Dutch, I'd like to see some of these guys get expelled. One thing I'd like is for the local Republicans, many of whom we know, who are terrific people. A number of them are in Baltimore County, decent people. They ought to expel this guy from the Eastern Shore. He voted with the insurrectionist. He doesn't wear a mask. He's a doctor. What?
Well, they had to throw him out at 3 o'clock in the morning. I was up at 3 o'clock in the morning. They threw him out of the hall, right?
And I know it's not, none of us want to talk about other folks in public life. It's not easy for us. It's not easy for me to want to dump on the president of the United States. Who wants to do that? We cherish these people, but we're at a different time. And folks who continue to push the conspiracy theories and continue to push them now really do not are not entitled to serving in public life.
Dutch, respond to both Ted. Dutch, respond to Ted and Nestor. Nestor's concerned about these knuckleheads not going through the metal detector. Heck, we come through metal detectors when we come to the county office building. You guys are in and out of there.
In general, meetings, I'm concerned that that there are people inside of where you are who have absolutely created everything that happened on the outside when they're passing metal detectors. What would happen if I tried to pass a metal? Yeah, I mean, that can't be tolerated.
Well, I think the one word is arrogance. These are individuals that represents constituents. And the fact that they will not show and give an example, especially when you have, we're probably the worst in the world in how we're managing the COVID virus. And I think they are so caught up in the Trump issue and the no mask as if it's a masculine thing. I can't understand it either. But I can tell you this. We talked about Nancy Pelosi, and Nancy's smooth, but she's tough. And I heard Nancy say a couple days ago that she will stand at the door. She's the speaker, and she can control the floor. And she will stand at the door to make these individuals come in without guns. I mean, it's ridiculous. I understand. I have a lot of friends from Texas. And they grew up with guns. They had guns when they were young. But there are certain rules in our society, and those rules have to be respected, especially when it comes to people's lives. And so, I look back at all this, as bad as it is, and it's bad. And what happened on January the 6th?
Those daggone earphones.
I know. I get it back in. Okay, but you look at what happened, on January 6th. You look at the COVID issue. We have to learn from those situations. But leadership is not always just following an individual and going down a path that you know if you have a brain that when people get together to have COVID, other people catch it. Look at these rallies that Trump has. I mean, no one with masks. I mean, that's ridiculous. Look at that crowd out there. No mask whatsoever. I mean, it makes no sense, as if they don't have a brain. When they do have a brain, they're just not using it.
And there you go. Well, Nestor, we have just scratched the surface. We didn't even get to talk about their years as county executive. I knew this would be special. It's the first of what we hope will be regular visits. I thank all of my friends for showing up. Nestor, thoughts?
Thank you very much. On behalf of Don Mohler, we have to say goodbye because I know Dutch has a window here. Ted, we will see you soon. Ted Venatoulis, Don Hutchinson, thanks for coming in. I got to get back over to the zoo because it's open spaces. Dennis Rasmussen joining us. Of course, all East Side guys, Dutch Ruppersberger. And, of course, on behalf of Don Mohler, we are WNST.net.
And don't forget, wait a minute, don't forget my former boss, County Executive Jim Smith.
Jim, you're muted. Did I forget Jim? Didn't I say Jim?
Got to represent the West Side.
Jim, I had a question for you about arrogance, decency in the judicial system. Can we do that next week?
Sure.
I want to talk judges with you, but I know we have a shorter window for Dutch. So, but I do want to talk judges because I think before we go, Jim, were judges at the heart of all of this with Trumpism and what the long play for Mitch McConnell was to get judges?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that it isn't the last couple of years. It is something that the Republicans have been working on for a long time and throughout the country. They want the federal bench, not just the Supreme Court, but they want the federal bench itself to be ultra conservative and really far right. That's the kind of people that they have had appointed since Trump has been president, but they also have gotten them appointed in prior years too, and that is the long game, and we'll see how it plays out because they truly do now have a very conservative Supreme Court, and it's going to be very interesting as to how it will operate. Clearly, Trump wanted to get some case to the Supreme Court that would throw out the election. I mean, he really wanted to test his appointments, and they just didn't let that happen. they wouldn't take the case in the Supreme Court, and none of the other federal cases dealt with issues that qualified for the Supreme Court to be the ultimate arbiter. So, yeah, I think the judiciary is a critical, it's one of the three branches of government, and it is a critical branch of the government. And it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out with all the issues that are going to be brought before it over the next few years, because there's going to be a lot of testing of Trump regulations changes. There's a lot of testing of things that he did when he was president, and that people are going to want to see undone, and we'll see how it all plays out. But yes, I think the Republicans had a pretty smart, if you will, long game in trying to capture the third branch of government.
Took them 8 days to get a Supreme Court justice, and they didn't want to do an impeachment in that period of time. Dutch, we appreciate everything you're doing down in D.C. Fellas, we'll all get together at some point. I swear, there'll be chicken and waffles. We'll have coffee, refreshments. Dutch, I'm going to torture you right now because I know you're not anywhere near Essex, so I got to get my Pizza John's up here for you.
The best.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
The best.
There you go. So we can all agree on that.
Oh, yeah.
The best.
Fellas, thank you very, very much. I'm going to go through it again. I'm not going to forget Jim Smith because I'm going to start with him, but I start with Ted Venatoulis, Don Hutchinson, Dennis Rasmussen, Dutch Ruppersberger, Jim Smith twice, and Don Moeller as well. Thanks, fellas. We really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
bye-bye,
everybody.
We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and with all of the Baltimore County executives, and we never stop talking, Baltimore positive.
Take care.